From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission. Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, Bay Area youth respond to the death of Trayvon Martin.
It's like it's a struggle being young and black, because it's like you're always looked at, you're always seen as suspicious, you're always gonna have this extra thing over you.
Also, a local high school junior is leading an environmental movement.
Like, I wanted to teach people and like have them have the same like passion that I do for like taking care of like the environment and keeping it healthy.
And a San Francisco supervisor wants to get tough on recycling scavengers. We'll look into this underground economy.
We're starting to get people that that are not even homeless and recycle. It's a pretty good business.
That and more today on Cross Currents. Criminal justice news continues to make national headlines with the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. Social networking sites are full of commentary on the killing.
Who are you to judge someone just because they're wearing a black hoodie and because of the color of their skin?
If you ever seen me and you decided to chase me and I don't see a badge, concealed carry permit holder. So I don't have a bag of Skittles,
I don't know about you, but if it's dark and late and there's a guy following me, I might start getting a little paranoid.
Many in the African American community are wondering how to talk to their sons about such tragedies. Gerald Gray and his son Jabari sat down to talk at Youth Radio, where Jabari is a development officer. For the multiracial family, the incident hits home.
When you were born, it was clear to me that you would be perceived as black. I knew certain things would happen that wouldn't happen to a child who appeared white. And that meant I had to live the way a lot of black parents live, particularly with black sons. Well, there's a tremendous amount of threat all of the time compared to white kids.
That's true. As I got older and I was out of the house and I was on my own, there were definitely incidents with the police, mostly centered around racial profiling, and then escalated to the point with the Berkeley police.
I think I got traumatized actually by a combination of that particular police threat to you under the gun and the incident when you and your friend were surrounded by six guys who wanted to attack you. And in both of those situations, as far as I was concerned, there was always a threat of death.
I'm kind of curious to know why it bothered you so much. You know, you felt the need to reach out to me when this thing happened to Trayvon.
Suddenly, the Trayvon Martin tapes came on the radio, and you can hear him yell once for help. And then there's a shot. And that just triggered my reaction all over again. Because he was obviously young and very afraid and in danger. So even though I knew you were here and safe and not in Florida or not someplace I didn't know, calling you was not really for your safety probably so much as to calm myself down just to hear your voice. I think that's the kind of thing that happens with many, many families where one of the children or more have been in danger. That kind of triggering stays within the parent. And you don't lose it.
When we spoke, it was around 11 o'clock a couple of nights ago. And I guess the thing that struck me the most was the last thing that you said to me, which was, you know, I wanted to make sure that you were safe. I realized that you said that to me not only because I'm your kid, but 'cause I'm black. And so then it kind of threw me back to this moment when we first had a dialogue about there being racial differences between the two of us because our family has always been very much just that, a family.
Look, where you go, there go I. There's no way I can separate myself from what happens to you. It's always with me. Once you have a child you love, you're hostage to the world. You're part of that child, and you just go where that takes you. You've been my heart, and I thank you for that.
That was Jabari Gray and his father, Gerald Gray. Their story was produced by Youth Radio, which also wanted to find out how young people in the Bay Area are relating their own experiences to Trayvon Martin's story.
It just seems totally wrong. There's definitely something wrong in our society or something.
There are more negative stereotypes for Black people in general than there are positive. You never turn on the TV and see a Black man being anything other than, you know, a gangster, a murderer, a rapper.
It's like it's a struggle being young and Black because it's like you're always looked at, you're always seen as suspicious, you're always going to have this extra thing over you basically that you can't fight no matter what you do. So it's always good to take extra precautions, whether that, you know what I'm saying, be like mace or just, you know, carrying yourself like you have some sense. It's just the way that you have to live.
I'm scared. I grew up in Alameda for most of my life, and there's still, I can kind of feel racial tension.
There's been stories, you know, that date back so long from people, you know, getting killed for, like, you know, having inhalers in their pockets or pulling at anything. It hits deep.
I've seen things like this happen to me before, but never to this degree. But it is things like small things like, you know, where the white woman has her purse and she clenches it, or they cross the street. You know, the typical things that you hear about. Like the way that this story is being presented, I see more people of like other ethnicities kind of taking a stand. So I feel that, you know, I may actually get more respect from this.
In the ideal America, it's not about accepting each other and loving each other, but I think it would be about finding a common ground.
Nothing is really different about anybody. I mean, my lips might be fuller, my hips may be wider, my hair may be different than yours, but if you cut me, I bleed the same blood as you. It's still red.
Those were the voices of Noah Martin Rubin, Rayana Godfrey, Miles Bess, Tiaja Harris, Evan Y.T. Childress, and Sayer Quevedo, produced by Youth Radio. To check out more Trayvon Martin coverage, go to youthradio.org and turnstilenews.com. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. Bay Area youth are exposed to activism at a young age, whether it's political, social, or environmental. Every year, the Bay Nature Institute honors people who are making outstanding contributions to the understanding and stewardship of the natural world. One of this year's awardees is Sean Fitzhoward. She's a junior at San Francisco's Lowell High School who founded the Protect the Bay Club. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down with Sean Fitzhoward and asked her about what her club does for the environment.
I basically arrange volunteer events for like the club to go, and I always go to all of them, and then I keep track of their hours. So we go, like, recently we went out to Pier 94. The high tide brought in some trash, so we picked that up, and then we also planted some native plants. So we do stuff like that, like habitat restoration. I like to do that kind of volunteer work the most, like being outside and stuff.
What are some of the fundraisers that you do, and what do you use the money for?
Yeah, so that is definitely a big part of the club. And so last year, we were really determined to raise $500 for Save the Bay. And so we were kind of thinking about, like, oh, what's, like, a popular food? And so we kind of had to be, like, business people. And we thought of popcorn, and it kind of grew. Like, first we just wanted, like, a little popcorn machine to sell popcorn, like, at these food days. And that grew into, like, going on Craigslist and finding, like, a big one, you know, those, like, big popcorn machine.
So this isn't one of those that has wheels on it, like, say, at Playland at the beach.
Well, yeah, it is just like that. Like, it's a replica of that. Like this company makes them. And usually they run, like, a couple hundred dollars, and we found one for $100 that was, like, brand new. So now what we do is we go up to 4 Star Video, which is on Cortland Street, like, in Bernal Heights, and we kind of know the people that work, like, run that place. So they're really nice, and they let us, whenever we want, basically sell popcorn outside their movie store, like, Friday, Saturday night. And, yeah, people, like, so we just kind of say, like, hey, like, we tell people what we're doing. Most people are really, like, enthusiastic about it, and they buy some popcorn, like, a small popcorn for $1, like, a large for $3. And sometimes people even donate. It's a lot of hard work doing that, but it definitely paid off because we raised just in that year, so last year, like $1,000, and 500 of that went to Save the Bay. So that was like our big thing we did. That was really cool to like hear how happy they were. Like they wrote us a nice letter. And then we also adopt animals from World Wildlife Fund and Defenders of Wildlife. So like a harbor seal, like 100 for a harbor seal, and it goes to World Wildlife Fund. And we get like a little harbor seal stuffed animal, which is our mascot now. So yeah.
That's Sean Fitzhoward. She's a junior at San Francisco's Lowell High School and founder of the Protect the Bay Club. How many members did you start with?
Well, basically just my friends. Yeah, like people I talked to about it, which would be like my friends mostly, they joined and they've been really dedicated members and helped me a lot ever since. So I'm really grateful to them. They're really good friends. And my sister, one of my best friends too, she is like the co-president. She helps me a lot. So they were the first members and they're like the best members now.
And what's the difference between just going out and volunteering or gathering some friends to go volunteer and having a club? What have you found to be different or that you've learned in organizing something like that?
That's a good question. Like, it's definitely, like, yeah, about the organization. So, like, I think that if I just said, hey, guys, like, let's go do this cool volunteer thing, I doubt that many people would go. But now that it's kind of with this, like, legitimate thing through school and they get hours, I keep track of it for them, and like I encourage them, like I have a little like passport thing where like I stamp it every time they come volunteer with us. Like I think that makes it fun and like kind of more exciting for them. And also it's helped me because like I'm kind of forced to go out on the internet mostly and like look for new volunteer opportunities, and I definitely wouldn't have found as many as I did if I didn't kind of under the pressure to like, okay, this week I have to like find a new volunteer thing for us to do, like something fun that I can invite them to.
That was Sean Fitzhoward speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. Fitzhoward won the Environmental Educator Award by the Bay Nature Institute. The latest edition of Bay Nature magazine is shining a spotlight on California's state parks closures. We have a link to a special report on the subject at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. San Francisco is considered a national leader in pro-environmental policy, advocacy, and education. And while the city is a pioneer in recycling, it may be getting tougher on street recyclers who scavenge from blue bins throughout the city. Supervisor Christina Olagi has requested a hearing looking into how much money the city's losing because of scavengers, as well as ways to prevent the practice. That investigation could begin next month. Street recycling is a growing underground economy, and it's illegal. In this story produced by Nasreen Atassi, Ben Trefney reports from our archives.
Up Market Street from San Francisco's Financial District, just below the San Francisco Mint, is a somewhat smaller scale repository and money exchange. In a corner of a grocery store parking lot, inside a metal-gated fence, is San Francisco Community Recyclers, a key way station in an underground economy.
We're starting to get people that that are not even homeless recycling. It's a pretty good business.
Jim Henry Hill III has worked at the recycling station for a few months. He empties contaminants, like cigarette butts, from the bottles and cans that recyclers turn in. Before Hill was an employee, he lived on the streets.
Well, I used to recycle, and you know, I was going from apartments to garbage cans. And I used to sell drugs at one time. I was all messed up. And then I just decided that, you know, I'm 45. I can't be doing this for the rest of my life. So I had to start somewhere. And as I was recycling, every day I was coming in asking, hey, can you use some help? Can I get a job? And finally it paid off.
Hill sees himself in many of the clients who come by the community recycler.
You know, you get all walks of life here. You know, mentally disturbed people. You get people that are just frustrated in life. You get drug addicts. You get even, you know, you get blue collar people. You get some people that might have lost their job and it's the only thing they could do to get money. So, you know, because the unemployment's not enough.
One man who's managed to earn some pretty good money recycling is Colombian immigrant Emedio Arango. After dropping off a load of cans and bottles, he pushes his hand-painted camouflage plastic cart out the gate of the community recycler. Arango wears camouflaged army gear, pants tucked into shiny black boots, and a Daniel Boone-style raccoon-tailed hat.
Yo realmente me dediqué fue al trabajo del reciclen hace unos cinco o seis meses.
Arango says he's been recycling regularly for 5 or 6 months. It pays for his cigarettes and food. He says he's content because it's peaceful and he can make a living. When Arango's working, he runs from dumpster to dumpster, rifling through garbage for recyclable containers. He's efficient. Arango says he knows many people look down on his choice of work, but he sees recycling through the eyes of a businessman. He says he works Monday through Sunday and makes about $50 or $55 every day. When the weather gets hotter, people start drinking more soda, water, and beer, so work increases. Arango says his cart can carry up to 350 pounds of recyclables, but there are others in this underground industry who operate on a larger scale.
When the recycle centers close at 5, their trucks come out and buy the recyclables.
Ricky Jones makes his recycling rounds at night, pushing a hijacked grocery cart down back alleys south of Market Street. Jones grew up in San Francisco and graduated from McAteer High School in 1988. Now, he's homeless. He wears a lanyard of keys around his neck, and he says they open up locked dumpsters. He bought them from another recycler for $15. Late one weeknight on South Van Ness, Jones is meeting with a truck-driving recycler, a middleman, to sell his collection of bottles and cans. Jones says working with people who operate after hours is a trade-off.
If I sell it at the recycle center, just for this right here, I get about $15. If I sell it tonight to the truck, just for this right here, he'll probably give me in between $8 and $10, depending on what I can talk him out of. So I'll be taking a little bit of loss, but I have it tonight.
And at this point in Jones's life, that's important.
Because I'm a suffering addict. You know, sometimes it just get hard, and I know it's there, so I collect it, get about $15, $20, and go do handle my business. And then I either stop or collect something for the next day.
For people living on the streets of San Francisco, that's something certain in their lives, something to hold on to. Because no matter how many cans and bottles Jones, Arango, and the city's other street recyclers collect, there will always be more to find the next day. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney in San Francisco.
How do you feel about street recycling? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time to meet your neighbors. Some things are just too valuable to throw away or take to the recycling bin. In fact, it would make more sense to collect them, as their value increases with time. There's this little radio repair shop in San Francisco's Inner Sunset that does just that. Zoe Corneli reports.
I used to live in the Inner Sunset, and every time I'd walk down Irving Street towards 19th Avenue, I'd pass the tiny storefront of Aladdin Radio Repair. The window was usually dark, but if I peered inside, I could see rows and rows of antique radios, gently curved plastic in pearly sea-green hues, hefty knobs, and ornate dials. How could I not be enchanted? The sign on the door said the store was open by appointment only, and it gave a number. It turns out the place is officially out of business, but the owner, John Wenzel, still comes in the mornings to repair radios for himself and his friends.
We took over this business in 1946. My wife and I were just out of the Army service, and we've had it ever since.
Wenzel invites me in. The store is a treasure trove of radio history. One wall is stacked high with thousands of colored boxes containing vacuum tubes.
They're left over from the old days.
But Wenzel says those are some of the only things that haven't changed in the past 60 years.
When we first moved here, there was no traffic, no parking meters. Park any place for all day. If you wanted a Chinese dinner in those days, why, you had to go to Chinatown. It was all family homes here then, and the kids went to their local school.
Wenzel says the Outer Sunset wasn't the residential district it is now.
Sutro Baths were at the beach, and that was a big public bathhouse, and I think you had to rent the bathing suit out there at the time. Also at the beach was Whitney's at the Beach Playland, which was full of games and rides, which was very popular.
And Wenzel's got lots of radios from those days.
This one here, that looks like a boat or has sails and everything. Those were prizes in the skee ball games at Whitney at the beach.
And so if I wanted to use one of these, what
well,
do I do?
You have to plug it into your house current, turn it on, and wait about 30 seconds to a minute for it to come up to operating temperature, and then it'll come on.
Wow. So it's much more of a kind of a physical process.
Yes, it is. This is an interesting one here. This one was made for the bedroom or also for blind people. It has no dial, and you turn it on by running your thumb over this roller. And now it's playing.
The radio is a black Bakelite construction that looks like it could be some kind of vacuum cleaner. No letters or numbers, just a speaker projecting out from a solid body and one big dial.
And if you push down on the thumb dial, it changes the station. But see, each time you press it, you get a different one.
Sports writer from the LA.
And then you turn it here and she's off.
Wenzel doesn't know how to fix modern solid-state radios. By the time they became standard in the 70s, he was ready to retire. So he converted his business to an antique repair shop. And he's got some unusual artifacts.
This one here, if you see the symbol there in the middle.
That looks like a Nazi symbol.
Yeah. This is a German radio called a People's Radio. Made in the 1930s, and Hitler demanded that the entire nation listen to his speeches during the 30s.
Now, this looks exactly like what you would expect from a Nazi radio. It is a black box, very stern, very
simple,
simple with the little eagle symbol with a swastika in it in the middle.
And these radios were made very cheaply, and every German citizen had to have one.
Wenzel points out a tag attached to one of the dials. It reminded Germans that listening to British or American shortwave radio was prohibited.
Well, the same thing in this country during the war. A lot of Japanese had radios. They were allowed to keep the radios, but if the radios had shortwave on them, they had to bring it to a radio shop like our shop here or any other shop, and the shortwave portion would be disabled, but the radio would still play on broadcast. I remember after the war, we used to get a lot of those radios in when the Japanese were released from internment camps and things, and then we would restore the radio back to shortwave again for them.
Wenzel shows me one last radio. It's about the size of a toaster oven, and it's definitely my favorite.
This radio is called a PlayPal. First, you open the side parts. There's a little compartment on each side of the radio. On one side, there's liquor bottles, and on the other side, there's glasses to drink. And if you raise the top up, there's a deck of cards, poker chips, and a set of dice. So you can listen to the radio, you can drink, and you can gamble all at the same time.
I only wish we could give out one of these as a thank you for pledge drives. In San Francisco, I'm Zoe Corneli for Cross Currents.
You can hear that and all our stories at kalw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Sarah Bernard, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Nina Gensler-Debs, Carolina Hidalgo, Jordan Katz, RTM's Konohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Moo, Rena Palta, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and David Waldorf. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share. They provide an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. And finally, we'd like to wish our managing editor, Martina Castro, a happy, happy birthday.
Happy birthday!
If you're looking for something civilized to do this April Fool's Day, consider attending a late afternoon Baroque music concert by Judith Linzenberg. You can hear her at the North Bray Community Church in Berkeley this Sunday. Concert begins at 5 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.